Welcome to The Final Cut. Jason DeRosso here with you again. Today, the legendary New York documentary maker and renowned hoarder Alan Berliner discusses his Sydney retrospective. Ex-cricketer Brett Lee explains his move to the big screen. But first, when was the last time you saw a film reference the Twin Towers? Well, Robert Zemeckis' new movie, The Walk, is many things, chief among them, a love letter to pre-9/11 Manhattan.
I make my way to the top, and I find myself standing on an island floating in midair on the edge of the void. Of course, I automatically look across to the opposite tower, but then I have to dare to look down.
It was on the morning of August 7, 1974, that the French high-wire artist Philippe Petit began the performance of a lifetime. Without any permits, aided by a small group of co-conspirators, he stepped out onto a wire attached between the 400-metre-high twin towers of New York's World Trade Center and began what essentially was a 45-minute show. Hollywood veteran Robert Zemeckis' film, The Walk, tells this story like it's a cinematic letter from Philippe Petit himself. In the lead role, looking every bit of French performance artist in a black turtleneck skivvy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt appears as the narrator of his own story, addressing the audience while standing atop the improbable but totally apt location of the Statue of Liberty torch. Breaking the fourth wall and delivering lines with the enthusiasm of a children's pantomime host certainly lends the film a blunt earnestness. But subtlety is not what co-writer and director Zemeckis is interested in, at least in storytelling terms. The film, inspired by Philippe's memoir, is whimsical, bordering on saccharine in its first French act, complete with a gypsy circus performer character, Papa Rudy, played by Ben Kingsley, who becomes a grumpy but affectionate surrogate father figure to Philippe. I haven't read the memoir, but it seems like Zemeckis relies a lot on artistic license and some old-fashioned band-aid solutions to package this story. For example, the idea that Philippe would speak to his French co-collaborators, including his girlfriend, played by an underutilized Charlotte Lebron, in English, just because he wanted to practice the language, seems a concession to mainstream American audiences and their legendary aversion to subtitles. But nitpicking over lapses in realism is kind of missing the point with this movie. Zemeckis has spun tales of sentimental, improbable adventure throughout his career, in films like Forrest Gump, for example. And with Gordon-Levitt, he's created a larger-than-life visionary that resembles a mixture of Christopher Lloyd's Mad Scientist and Michael J. Fox's Wide-Eyed Kid from his 1985 hit Back to the Future. An annoying narcissist in some ways, but worthy of our admiration given the audacious stunt that he pulls, which is treated in cinematic terms as a heist. In its climax, The Walk is a reminder of how cinema works well when it's simply depicting a process that requires great human skill and relies on luck. Zemeckis gathers a familiar mix of thriller elements, an elaborate plan that relies on avoiding pitfalls like patrolling guards, a series of intricate tasks to fasten the wire, and then the walk itself. Working with the Polish cinematographer Darius Wolski, who also shot The Martian, Zemeckis uses 3D to thrilling effect, making the most of shot angles that hover near the edges of the building and eventually float above the wire itself, looking down into the abyss. At this point, any memory of the 2008 documentary Man on Wire, an effective but much leaner telling of the same event, fades away in comparison. In all of this, an unspoken but implicit significance of the film is the conjuring of New York in a simpler, more idealistic era. Certainly the kinds of security measures in place around landmarks today would make a similar feat impossible. The Walk shows us the city reflected in the eyes of an optimistic, appreciative Frenchman, just another in a long line of grateful immigrants depicted on screen who have looked to New York with hope. It's part of the mythology around this stunt that New Yorkers only began to love the World Trade Center after Philippe's high-wire act encouraged them to see it differently, with affection. Whatever the truth to that, there aren't many films that have engaged directly with these buildings since the attacks of 9/11. Spike Lee's 2002 crime thriller 25th Hour is a notable exception, with its early shot of the New York skyline featuring the twin beams of light shooting into the sky where the towers once stood. and a later scene in an apartment overlooking the gaping hole of Ground Zero, a traumatic image that's like an open wound. The Walk is a soothing balm by comparison, a dream of what once was. It would be dismissive to call it nostalgic, though not entirely untrue. It works, mostly, as the depiction of a man who gave us a rare magical moment, when the abyss, momentarily, lost its power over us. The Walk is out now.
I like her.
Yeah, forget about it, mate. That is not a good idea.
Why not?
She's not some chick you can pick up at a bar.
All right, educate me. How do I pick up an Indian chick?
Firstly, she's not an Indian chick.
She's a hottie with a dot. Boom.
Hey, that is offensive. The dot has real cultural significance on my people, okay?
I'm sorry, man. What's the cultural significance?
I don't know.
There have been several recent Indian-Australian co-productions made in this country for the Bollywood audience, but this week sees one inspired by the Hollywood romantic comedy template. Un-Indian is a love story about a blonde-haired Australian bloke teaching Aussie English to international students at university and a divorced Indian PR exec relocated to Sydney with her young daughter and parents. While he's smitten and she might be interested, there are significant obstacles, most notably her parents' resistance to the idea of her marrying anyone outside their culture, and her ex-husband, who turns up in a plot twist later in the film. The title Un-Indian is an obvious play on the recent catchword of our times, un-Australian, and the film takes on petty prejudices with tolerance and good humour. But Australian producer-turned-director Anupam Sharma lacks the budget and the originality to create a compelling fantasy from the well-worn elements, and only touches on the tragicomic potential of the modern cosmopolitan metropolis as a place where cross-cultural connections and misunderstandings go hand in hand. Undoubtedly, he has an ace up his sleeve, though, with the former cricket star Brett Lee in the lead role, who acquits himself well, underplaying the emotions and managing a real chemistry with his delightful co-star, the very experienced Tanistha Chatterjee, who was nominated for a BAFTA for her role in Brick Lane. But mostly, Un-Indian is a curiosity, and a very interesting model as a business venture too, where private capital from the Australia-India Film Fund, which was set up by Anupam Sharma with IT mogul Devendra Gupta, played a major part in getting the project made. Despite a couple of Bollywood-inspired dance numbers, Un-Indian is also squarely aimed at a Western audience. Anupam Sharma.
Look, this film was always conceived for a Western audience. This film is an outright Australian script. It's an Australian story. It's a different kind of Australian story. We are trying to redefine Australian stories with this film, but it was always intended for a Western audience.
You've brought more than 200 different sort of projects here that have been Indian-Australian collaborations, from TV commercials to other sorts of television and some features. This is your first time as director, though. But tell me about your philosophy for an Indian-Australian feature film collaboration.
Well, the philosophy of bringing all those Indian films to Australia was purely my interest in Indian films and my love for Australian films. I wanted to inject new life, new money, new investment. And we literally started a niche industry, which is now multi-million dollar per year, benefiting so many Australian crews around Australia, even though I'm not as much a part of it because I've gone into directing. But the philosophy behind Australia-India Film Fund was very simple. We did some research and we found out that India-centric films made by non-Indians have got quite a high strike rate. Combined with my philosophy of Eastern soul and Western body, which is Western narrative, Western scripts, Western style of storytelling, with the Indian soul of music and color and drama. And that's one of the reasons why a Slumdog Millionaire or a Bandit Like Beckham finds resonance with audience around the world.
And it's funny, they don't necessarily do well in India, do they?
They're very much
Indian-flavoured Western films that do Absolutely. Well internationally.
Yeah, I mean, Best Exotic Marigold, classic example again. So these are films, I mean, keep in mind when films came to India first, they came as a form of escape. 2 weeks after Lumiere Brothers exhibited them in France, Indians suddenly found the answer to unifying them for escape, for entertainment, for everything through and in cinema. Because in that dark theatre, low caste, high class, low class, rich, poor, they all became one for one unified aim of escape. And that's what Bollywood films are used for. They're out and out means of escape. I love them. We enjoy them. But this film and the Film Fund is here to tell more Australian stories with more meaning and more ambitions in terms of their narrative, in terms of their structure, in terms of the investment.
Director Anupam Sharma. As mentioned, Un Indian stars former Australian cricketer Brett Lee. How was it making the transition from the pitch to the big screen?
You know, I guess the best way to answer that is I've every time I've walked on the cricket field, I guess I've looked at myself as being a bit of an actor, because I'm out there to try and entertain, to try and have fun with the crowd, to try to stir the batsman up, try to convince the umpire to put his finger up and give the batsman out. So I've been playing a different role as to what I'm like off the field. So I guess the last 2 or 3 years, when there's a few offers coming in to potentially work on a film, the time wasn't right. I was still playing cricket. And then when this opportunity came through from Anu, who I've known for, you know, a decade now, I thought the movie seemed right. It's got a great message in it. It's an Australian-made film with my love for the Indian culture. So I thought it's a win-win. Have a go.
When you spent 6 years playing in India, describe to me what that scene is like amongst the, you know, professional cricketers out there, because I imagine that you must rub shoulders with the massive film industry in India at the same time. You must sort of be socialising together and so forth. Is it that sort of fluid?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I played the first 3 years under Priti Zinta, who is one of the biggest Indian actresses that they've got, certainly in Bollywood, who's a terrific woman and a great friend of mine as well. The last 3 years I played under Shah Rukh Khan, who's probably the biggest actor in India, or one of the biggest actors in India, who's also a great guy, a great leader.
When you say played under, you're talking about they...
The owners of the team, yeah. So yeah. They both... See, it's if you look at cricket over in India, and, you know, the best way to be involved in the 1.3 billion people that all love cricket, in terms of an actor, was to be aligned with the cricket team. And the Indian Premier League's one of the biggest leagues in the world. So, of course, a lot of the big actors said, we'll buy a team. As you do, just go and buy an Indian Premier League team. And, yeah, Priti Zinta chose me in the first 3 years, and then Shah Rukh Khan chose me in the last three. So I had a lot of mates back home were jealous because I was playing under Priti Zinta. And then a lot of female friends back home were jealous I was playing under Shah Rukh Khan.
Did you ask them for tips?
I asked them, yeah, what it's like on set. What's it like? Is there a similarity between what you've seen here in cricket and then going on to the sets? And they said, yeah, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of downtime, as there is with cricket, being on tour. There's a lot of scrutiny from the media if you don't have a good day. So there's a lot of things that I've taken from the cricket field and brought them onto, you know, the set.
Brett Lee, star of Un Indian, which releases this week. You're on The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso.
Someone in the audience is watching right now and saying, why am I here watching this film about this guy?
I would ask too, because I don't know what the hell they're doing here. I'm being honest with you.
You should be honored.
I'm not.
Your life not only can be...
My life is nothing. My life is no different from I don't know how many billions of people's. Who the hell would care about Oscar Berliner? Who the hell am I? You know, it's ridiculous.
Everyone has a life that has something special about it.
No.
Your life has nothing special?
No.
Nothing?
Look.
How could you be so convinced about that?
You're trying to make something of nothing.
You're my father. I have to do it. I need to do it.
You don't have to do it.
I have to do it.
Alan, you're going to do what you want to do, whether I want you to do it or I don't want you to do it. I'm telling you, you're wasting your time.
This week, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney is showing a retrospective of the films of American documentary maker Alan Berliner as part of the Antenna Documentary Film Festival. It's a rare occasion, all the more special because Berliner is in the country to present the films. His poetic and inventive documentaries deal with recurring themes of family and identity. He often appears in them too, as do clips from his extensive private collection of home movies, training films and newsreels that serve as metaphors or illustrations or make fascinating visual rhymes. He's a filmmaker interested in collage and structural play. His 2013 film, First Cousin Once Removed, is a haunting, striking portrayal of his cousin, the renowned poet and translator Edwin Hoenig, battling Alzheimer's disease, which of course is a progressive degenerative condition, but explored in the film with looping edits to evoke poignant resonances between different time periods. Other films screening at the MCA are Nobody's Business, about his father, Wide Awake, a film about his battle with insomnia on the verge of becoming a father for the first time, and The Sweetest Sound, about the name Alan Berliner and the various Alan Berliners. Here's Alan Berliner.
I realized quite a long time ago that I was, if nothing else, a collagist. And so I set about, rather unconsciously, especially at the beginning, doing what collagists do. I surrounded myself with things to put together. Whether I knew what I would do with them at the moment or not, it didn't matter. If it somehow intrigued me, if it held promise, if it had some kind of numinosity of some sort, I saved it. I'm also a very organized person, so when I save things, I put them in places where I can find them in the future. That's also very important to me. So I have a lot of things, but they're very organized. 16mm motion picture film, color motion picture film, audio tapes, quarter-inch cassettes, what have you, videotapes. I have 35mm transparencies, found photographs, you know, boxes of Life magazine up to the ceiling. I have a lot of miscellaneous mixed media in my studio. With regards to video footage or film footage that I use in my films, I made some, I don't know, realizations. Some had some epiphanies early on as well about the way that I could work with them. Number one, it allows me, in the telling of personal stories, it allows me to create moments of distance and go outside myself. And the primary way I do that is because you can use images in a film I made about my father, for instance, Nobody's Business. I introduce two fighters boxing, two boxers. And what that does is you see that they're boxing and one gets hit, the other falls down, he gets up, hits the other, and they fall down. So I've established a kind of metaphor for my relationship with my father. It branches out to become a metaphor for the relationship between generations. You know, it extends out and out. And it's also, you see that no one's really winning, so it's about the resiliency of the game, the sparring, not necessarily the conquering.
I want to ask you about this remarkable film you've made about your now deceased cousin. It's called First Cousin Once Removed. It involved years of interviews with your cousin, Edwin Hoenig, quite a lot older than you, a man deteriorating with Alzheimer's, but a man of letters. He'd been a renowned scholar, translator, poet. This is a very linear deterioration, Alzheimer's, but, well, in some ways, you're going
to
correct me.
I'm going to beg to differ.
Well, beg to differ by all means, and in that, can you explain why you've chosen to edit the film in such a wonderfully interesting way, because you don't, it's not a linear story.
Right. Well, thank you for the opportunity. Alzheimer's is a progressive disease, but it's not linear. You know, you could be very surprised by someone who is unable to talk, we'll just say cogently, not even lucidly, cogently today. And then you can come back in 3 months and then they can have a cogent conversation with you, you know? And that's interesting in terms of the sort of the parts of that disease that we know and then we don't know. But it's also true the way memory works in general. So it is with Edwin, my cousin Edwin in the film. You know, I could have a conversation with him today and then in a month from now, not a great conversation, but the following month, we would have an incredibly lucid and an engaging time. And I decided to introduce into the film, instead of editing the film in linear time, which would imply this sort of the decay of Alzheimer's. Certainly he would be getting older physically, but I think the mind, the cauldron of the mind, is much more complex. And I think it would be deceptive, or deceiving is a rather word, if I had pretended that that was the case. I decided to introduce, therefore, a kind of cubist storytelling. Acknowledge that I was going there many, many times, and feel free to intercut those visits, you know, and let him complete sentences from months before or a year later. And in doing so, it freed me up to give the film a much more fragmented but hopefully poignant storytelling. In other words, that I could make more meanings out of his answers or his inability to answer us by dealing with the words and the meanings and the symbolic implications and just the memory or not memory as the overriding imperative of the film, rather than time is moving forward and he's going to die because he has Alzheimer's. That seemed, and perhaps those films have already been made.
The other question that springs to my mind watching your films is that, and because they are such sort of intimate portraits sometimes of your own family, that can reveal some unvarnished sort of realities, truths. You include in your films moments of, you know, protestation, really, from some of your subjects, you know, your family members saying, "Ah, oh, I don't even know if this is interesting. Why are you even doing this film? I don't want you to film this," yada, yada. What's the process of bringing people around?
Well, what to say? First of all, they now, I'd like to think, they know me, they respect me, and they know that it's what I do. You know, I work for the forces of good. I don't work for the forces of evil. Whatever I'm interested in, they know that I've thought it through a bit and that I'm interested in creating an experience that's going to transcend us, our names, our family dynamics specifically, that I'm trying to reach audiences at a deeper place, you know, and talk about, you know, love and family contract and family relationships and, you know, the deeper and broader and more resonant parts of family and the poetics of life, you know. Listen, when I first began the film, there were some protestations. Now, if I don't include my mother or my sister or my nieces in the film, they're upset with me, you know. And I think two films that I made sort of set the tone for that very quickly. I made this film about my grandfather called Intimate Stranger. My grandfather had been in the middle of writing his autobiography, and he was killed in a hit-and-run car accident and died. And 16, 17 years later, I went back to my uncle's office and found all the boxes of his undertaking. Everything had just been thrown off the tables into the boxes, taped up, and they remained in the dark for all this time, dusty, moldy boxes. And I opened them up and I said, you know, I'm going to make a film about my grandfather who died in the middle of writing his autobiography, but I don't know why. You know, why was he writing an autobiography? I didn't get that. And I think I managed to make a film that showed that whatever delusions my grandfather held about his life or his role in the world, and he was an ordinary person. No one's ever heard of him. He never had an obituary in the newspaper. That doesn't matter. Any life that's looked into deeply and passionately yields meaning, yields stuff. And I think that coupled with the film I made that followed that called Nobody's Business about my father, in which my father basically says, I'm a nothing and a nobody. In the end of the film, my father reveals more through the resistance of telling his story, more through his humility that my life is nothing and no one would be interested. He reveals more about himself, far, far more about himself than had he actually agreed proactively to participate and say, yeah, I was in the army and this is, you know, in terms of the storytelling. And what that film proved is that, you know, here's someone who's vocal, vociferous, he's alive, and he's telling an amazing story that no one needs to know about and no one really has the need to care about, but yet he's making it fascinating in his resistance. And I'll finish by saying this, sorry for the long stories, but then my friends and my family realized that I can turn that kind of stuff into experience that's meaningful to audiences and that has, that transcends the names, places, dates, and specificity, you know, into something that, you know, has mythic power.
Documentary maker Alan Berliner, the retrospective of his films is screening at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney as part of the Antenna Documentary Film Festival. And that's it for another week on The Final Cut. If you're in Sydney next Thursday and you can get to the University of Technology in Ultimo, do come along for a symposium on the late films, the digital films of Jean-Luc Godard, In Praise of Love, Film Socialism, and Goodbye to Language. This symposium lasts the whole day, and I'll be chairing a panel in the mid-afternoon. That's a symposium on the late films of the veteran master director Jean-Luc Godard at the University of Technology in Sydney next Thursday. Well, that's The Final Cut. I'm Jason DeRosso. You can find me on Twitter at JDRRR. I'll see you next week.